Hey everybody, it's Nolan North, you know, Nathan Drake from Uncharted, and you're listening to the Geek Apocalypse, our podcast.
Hello everybody, welcome along to episode 102 of the Geek Apocalypse podcast. Yes, we're really motoring along now. We're past the 100 mark. I really do encourage people because it's super duper long. It's almost like having four podcasts in two with the extra episode for the 100th episode. So it's really 100 and 101. So the 100th episode's kind of fallen apart on that criteria. But hey, and yeah, so I really do encourage you people to check it out if you haven't already. I spent a great deal of time on that. I'm aware I've only done two episodes this year, as in the 100th and the 101. So we're going to try and catch up. And the reason this episode with Mark Steer is now instead of the next episode is because I, for some reason, put 102 in the video version that I will get eventually to put on YouTube. So we're going to put this first, and the original one that was going to be 102 with Chris Warburton Brown, we're just moving to 103. That's probably irrelevant to anyone, especially if you don't watch the video version, but just letting you know that's the reason, and give you Casey going, this is the wrong guest that was on the website. So there you go. Problem solved. Also, I should say quickly about the delay of episodes. The reason for that is because I've been working very diligently on the web series, which I'll talk about in a second, as well as my laptop has been in for repair. The tech goblins have strike again, so that's kind of the reason for the delay. So I apologise profusely. But in terms of Twitch, we're back on Sundays, Elder Scrolls Sunday, and I have a video blog on YouTube, which is Geekpocalypse on YouTube, so please have a look at that. But yes, so in relation to this episode, it is with Mark Stay, who is Robot Overlords, which is a film you can find on a bunch of different places on the internet and on DVD, and also the novel, which I actually own, which he gave me from MCM London, which is where I met him, and he's a super-duper fun guy. The film stars Gillian Anderson and Sir Ben Kingsley, so obviously talk to him about that, how the film came to be, how he decided to do the novelization, and also we touch on all the other stuff that he's working on, which is super-duper cool. So he's super, super fun. If you want to follow him on Twitter, you can do so at @MarkStay. And he's on also on the interwebs, which is unusually tall, www.unusuallytallstories.com, where he has a blog and various other things, which is super, super cool. But he's a super, super fun guest. Had a great time. He's welcome on any time, as he knows. And we talk about, obviously, films and, you know, independent versus mainstream, because there's a mainstream British film. British versus America, I know, comes up because obviously the difference in money and various other things. But yeah, he's a super, super guest, so I really do hope you enjoy it. So enjoy when it comes on. But yes, as I said, in terms of the web series, very briefly, we've cast Chloe. A girl named Tanya Ormerod is going to be Chloe, and William Brown's going to be Ed. Got an animator, Legmog, who's a fan of Geek Apocalypse. Shout out to him. He's going to be involved in the animation. We've got my friend Wayne doing production, as well as Julie. It's a really super duper duper fun thing. We're now out of pre-production and now we're going to be filming it very, very soon. Follow us on Twitter @geek_apocalypse if you want to keep in touch with that. But it's a super fun series. But until then, tell you more about it in 103. But this is episode 102 with Mark Stay. Enjoy! I forget to do. Anyway, as I say, I'll start that again. So anyway, as I say, huge thank you to Mark Steer for coming on the podcast again. It's much, much appreciative. So I suppose, as I was just saying to Mark in the sort of when we have the little tiny minute chat before the Skype conversation starts, is thought the obvious point to talk to you about would be UK, not UK Games, but MCM, I should say, MCM London.
Yes.
Which is where we met. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what have you been up to since then, and how did you enjoy the convention as a whole?
I love the convention. It was a really, really good time. I've MCM supported Robot Overlords from the very beginning. We did the Birmingham one, which I think was in May, mm-hmm. and we were sort of introduced, if you like, by Pat Mills from 2000 AD,
who
was, you know, very supportive of the project. Mm-hmm. Loved the fact that it was a British science fiction film that appealed to the kind of, you know, certainly John and I, John Wright, the director of Robot Overlords, both huge fans of 2000 AD when we were growing up. So to have Pat Mills there saying, this film is great, it's, you know, it's really good fun, it's British and blah, 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 was hugely, hugely heartening. And we got a great response. I mean, all we had then was the trailer. And we've done a few. We did sort of two or three throughout the year. Julian Anderson went to one of the MCMs in London earlier in the year and introduced an exclusive clip. She did a Q&A with John. Nice. And I was asked by a fellow author, a guy by the name of Kit Cox, who sells books there.
Yeah, who we spoke to as well. He was on the same podcast as you,
Cool. He said, do you want to come along and sell some copies of your book? And I thought, because it's the one thing I had, all these Comic Cons I've been to throughout the year, the book wasn't available. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, why the hell not? Let's give it a go. I did very well.
Yeah.
And it was a great day. You meet so many extraordinary people, you know, and it's, some have seen the film, some haven't got a clue about it, and you get to pitch it to them all over again. I had one guy come up to, he saw the poster in the book, and he said, Robot, he said, I auditioned for that. it was a young actor who auditioned for one of the roles in the film.
Right, yeah.
So, excellent. It was an extraordinary day. It was really, really good fun. And it's, I mean, my kids came along that day. My kids love the cons. They cosplay and, you know, they have a great time. And it's a lovely environment. It's kind of, I always equate it, it's a bit like going to a football match, you know. Mm-hmm. Everyone's, it's everyone's on the same kind of wavelength, you know. And just as football fans will dress up and put on a shirt that says Messi on the back so they can wear that badge, you know, you'll see someone going by dressed as Harley Quinn or the Joker or something like that. So I love it. I feel at home at those places. It's very cool.
No, I can imagine. So you were saying something that interests me in your answer there where you said, was that the first time you were saying, am I right, did I get this right, that that's the first time you've ever went there just to sell your book?
Yeah.
So what were you doing before, just pitching stuff?
I've gone to various cons as a fan, again, with the family before. Yeah. And then we did, anything we did was solely for the film, essentially. Any of the official sort of engagements we had were just for the film. Mm-hmm. I've done all sorts of book festivals, things like EasterCon and Nine Worlds throughout the year, which, you know, the focus there is on books. So it was interesting to take a book of a film to a film and games Comic-Con. There aren't, I mean, there's loads of comic books there, but there aren't many books there. And it does puzzle me why publishers don't get in on that action. Mm. I mean, the footfall on the Saturday alone was 100,000 people.
Yeah.
All with money in the pocket, all fans of the genre.
Yeah, yeah.
And all looking for something new, you know. So
we talked to a guy, I don't know, like, did you kind of, how did you get involved in being with MCM? Did they ask you, or did someone else that was there? Was it Kit?
Well, for that particular occasion, it was Kit. For the film, it was something that was organised through the distributor.
Yeah. Because what I find interesting, to finish my thought, it was just what I was leading to was, we spoke to a guy there called Dan Thompson, who, I don't know if you saw, was literally to the right of you. I mean, my memory of it, because I must have circled the convention, as you probably saw about a million times, is that to the right of you, there was like the comic booky section, and we spoke to a guy there called Dan Thompson, who ended up on the podcast, and he was doing a comic book called The Moon.
Right.
And it's very interesting. I actually took a picture of me holding this like plastic moon that he had as an example, which I thought was cool. And I was like wanting to do a Dr. Evil impression, you know, taking the moon over. But he was telling me, I don't know whether it was on the podcast or not, it might have been, but he was telling me that it was like a comic village thing, and it was not necessarily that MCM like kind of okayed them to be part of it. But what I find fascinating about it is, it's almost like the convention's just planned, and then people kind of just apply not only to be part of like media like we were, which is slightly done slightly differently, but they all kind of gather together to go, we want to come here because we know that's their audience. Which, to your point, the reason I'm bringing this up is because it sounds like, you know, like the point you're saying is that some people are missing a trick, because it's almost like the writers know more than publishers do, which is half the reason why people, I think, are becoming independent. Is that a fair thing?
No. Okay. I'd say, I mean, I was there as a guest. I was on a panel. Mm-hmm. I think if you're to get one of those stalls costs a lot of money.
Yeah,
and I didn't have any financial outlay whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I think publishers have the festival circuit. Authors are paid to turn up to those. I don't think MCM would be willing to pay authors to turn up and then sell their own copies of the books, but festivals do that.
Yeah.
But having experienced it myself, there's always stuff going on behind closed doors. You know, there's always money exchanging hands. I think, you know, if you're a vendor and you're selling toys and merchandise and stuff like that, then you'd have paid an awful lot of money for that floor space. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously how the Comic Con makes its money.
Yeah.
So if you're going to give over a whole swathe of space to authors who just aren't used to paying for that space, or then it's, I don't know, it's...
Fair enough.
But I think if the opportunity is there, if you're an author and the opportunity comes along as it did for me, then you should take it. And mm-hmm. I would again, I think.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular reason why you didn't? Were you apprehensive about going to do these book things? Because you said that was the first time, or was that just because the book would just come out then? Or was there any particular reason why you hadn't done that before?
What, as in a big Comic-Con? Like
gone with your book to a convention or something and go, I'm going to do that? Were you apprehensive about it, or was it just circumstance?
Not apprehensive. It's just, like I say, I'd never seen authors there before. So when, you know, the Pat Mills one, which was the first one, he very kindly bigged up the book. And I thought, oh, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes, you can. Yeah, it's overrating.
Bollocks. I should have brought the book. Not only brought the book, but a box of the book, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an afterthought, really. Nice. I was so focused on the film that I thought it didn't occur to me. Mm-hmm. And the other times it came along, there just wasn't the opportunity to do it. If you're going to do these things, you do need to do it properly.
Yeah.
When Kit asked me, I figured, actually, that's a good space, a good opportunity in which to do it. People will have seen the film. It's available.
I totally agree. And not only that, as we were touching on the area you were in, I wanted to ask you, just as this little fun side thing, what was it like sitting next to Bob Layton and Kit Cox for the whole time? Because that must have been nice.
Well, Kit's great, and he's very experienced at these things. He's done lots of them. So, you know, on a Friday afternoon when it was getting quiet, he was there to reassure you and say, you know what, this is normal. Anyone after 5 o'clock, you sort of, you know, start chatting to them and you try and sell them your book, and they're like, I'm skint.
Yeah.
I've spent all my money for the day.
My friend who met, Wayne, who was with me, who was working with me at the time, he had spent all his money by the Friday. Like, to prove your point, yeah. So he's probably going, right, I can't get this. I've spent it all. So yeah.
One of the things I did was pinpoint the location of the free cash machine. You know, the one that didn't charge you. So if any, I said, "What
everyone does?
Just go through that door, down the stairs. There's one there."
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was
nice.
It was
of them
good
to do. Usually they don't.
I mean, Bob Layton was just, he was nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
He's a superstar artist, so I didn't get to chat to him very much, but when I did, he was always good fun and entertaining.
Yeah.
And I can't repeat half of the stories he told me.
he was great at us when we did get the opportunity to speak to him. As you say, he never stops sort of to want to talk to fans and whatnot, because we had to stop several times because people wanted to sign stuff. Yeah. Which happens at them places, which I understand. And yeah, he told us stories about, like, Robert Downey Jr., because I asked him about Robert Downey Jr. obviously taking over a character that he made, and he was very complimentary. And what I loved as well is that even if you go on, like, his stuff online, like, he seems to, like, reuse that picture of him, which I don't blame him, because I would do the same, of him next to Jon Favreau, next to Robert Downey Jr., and him going, like... It was on the front of his desk as you walked up to him, and I'm going, well, I already know who he is because he's famous in comic book land, but, you know, the fact that he's just to prove, he's going, look at this picture.
I'd have that printed on 1,000 cards and give it out to everyone I met, wouldn't you?
You would have it on your front cover. I don't know why, like, and I know this is just me being half silly, but if it was me having rewatched the film, and I'm sure I want to get to the film process a little later, but if I had a film with Ben Kingsley in it, I would that's what I would do. I would just go, well, what have you done with your life? Well, I had a film, and not only did I have a film, but look who was in it. That fine actor. But yeah, so it was interesting. But yeah, I imagine that was fun. Kit was. Kit was really, really, really flamboyant. And
he's great.
I would like to do a full podcast with him, actually. I should make sure I make time for him, because he was so nice. I mean, I think you guys were actually going to a seminar, weren't you, I believe? So I had to hurry up, but he was just I'm really sorry, guys.
We did a panel, yeah. Funny, yeah. Kit's been in touch recently. He's doing a radio play.
Oh, nice.
Which I think he's going to put out online, and nice. He's cast me in a couple of small roles.
Very nice.
So there's that. So maybe you can talk to him about that when it comes along.
All right, sweet. So I will do. Yeah, I would say yeah. I he's on my radar to do a full show with, because the podcast I'm referring to, for people who haven't heard it, is the MCM special we did with a bunch of people, and Mark was on it, as well as Kit and RJ Mitty and Nolan North, a bunch of people from MCM London. And Kit Cox, I wanted to talk about, because when I did a little research before I met him, I didn't know about his books, but I did a little research and found out that he did a Steve Jackson game, and I can't off the top of my head remember what it was called, but when I just saw it was a Steve Jackson game and he was involved in it, I wanted to talk to him about it. And I got so involved with talking about him, he said at the end, "I've got to go, but didn't you want to talk to me about that?" I totally forgot to ask him, so he reminded me at the end. He's like, "Before I go, you wanted to ask me about that?" Oh, yeah.
Get him on for the full hour.
Yeah, I imagine we'll have a lot to say, yeah, most definitely. But anyway, yeah, so as we've touched on, we've said, you've already hinted about Robot Overlord, which is a reason you were there to promote that book.
Available in all good
bookshops. Yeah, yeah. Let's match. I deliberately got it. I deliberately went and got it out of my bookshelf, which I will show for the benefit of the video. I'm trying to remember where you signed it. Was it the front? I think it was.
Usually is.
Yeah. There it is. I don't know whether you can see it. There you go. His scrawly Mark Steer writing, but it's very sweet. It's very sweet. To Stephen, deaf to robots, which is pretty sweet. Yeah, MCM London, 25th of the 10th. Pretty sweet. But yeah, so I deliberately got it out. But one of the mistakes I made when I first interviewed you there, which is what I want to talk to you about now, is I was like, assumed that the book came out first, because that's usually what happens in processes like that, where films are based on a novel or something like that. But that wasn't the case. So I want to kind of talk to you about how that happened. Yeah, how did the film come about?
Well, okay. I'm glad you got an hour here. I mean, yeah,
the reason of the podcast.
I've been writing since I was a kid. Uh-huh. I always enjoyed writing. I had no contact with the film world whatsoever. It may as well have all been on another planet. So the idea of writing for film, which it just seemed like something magical, something otherworldly to me. And I did write a lot of prose, wrote stories and comic books. I also wanted to act, which I foolishly thought would be easier. And I enjoyed acting. I liked it very, very much. Mm-hmm. I met my wife through acting. We both got a place at drama school, but I was working at Waterstones Booksellers at the time, mm-hmm. and she got the grant to go to drama school. That ages me. And I said, drama school probably drive me up the wall anyway, so I'll keep working at Waterstones. And I wrote sort of plays on the night shift at Waterstones, at Wimbledon, because you'd be there till 9 o'clock in the evening, and there was usually just one guy wandering around that's probably a shoplifter anyway. And I kept writing, and we formed our own theatre company. Mm-hmm. And we did other people's plays. We did like David Mamet and people like that. And I wanted to do a play by Johnny Spaight, the guy who did Alf Garnett, Till Death Do Us Part.
Yeah.
And he passed away, and I couldn't get the rights to his play all of a sudden. But I had a venue booked and no play. And I had about 8 weeks. So I wrote a play in a real hurry about all the terrible camping holidays my parents had taken me on as a child. And it was really good fun, and it was it went down really well. We got really good reviews. People laughed all the way through. And a friend of mine who was funnily enough, he did one of the extras on the DVD now. He makes documentaries and music documentaries and does live music and stuff. Yeah. But he just started in TV as like a cable basher, as an apprentice camera operator. Mm-hmm. And he took me to one side and he said, "Look, there are too many actors," he said, "but not enough writers. But you can write." And I think that's all any writer needs to hear, is some kind of affirmation that you can do this. And so for the next sort of 4 or 5 years, I wrote plays. Mm-hmm. And what became very clear was that I'm not a playwright. What I was writing were essentially movies on a stage. And I'd made efforts to make contacts and meet people. There'd be sort of meet and greets and networking things for film people and writers and stuff. And I met an agent through that. Mm-hmm. And I sent her a play, and she thought it might make a good book. But I also started working on screenplays then. And one of those screenplays got the attention of a producer called Dean Fisher, who produces excellent independent British films. And he introduced me to John, which is nearly 10 years ago. It'll be 10 years ago this summer that I first met John. And that script was a sort of low-budget horror. We got into the London microwave scheme and realized that we really enjoyed working together.
Yeah.
And so he gave me something else he'd been working on, said, do you want to rewrite that? And we just started bouncing ideas back and forth since. And then about 6 years ago almost, he emailed me out of the blue saying that he'd had this terrible dream where there were robots outside in the street.
Okay.
And he was playing with a little boy. Now, he's got a son now. He didn't have a son at the time. Mm-hmm. But he was playing with this boy, and they were sort of playing with Nerf guns. And this robot said to them, put away your weapons or you'll be vaporized. And he said, there's something in that, something about being trapped inside and robots. And he was convinced someone had done it before. And we asked around, and he put together a really good pitch for it. And he was in post-production on his second film, Grabbers, which, if you haven't seen, is on Netflix now. Excellent. All right. Monster movie called Grabbers. Really, okay. Really good fun. And he was in post on that, and one of the producers of that, Piers, he came in and said, I'm looking for a family science fiction movie. Have you got any ideas? And it just so happened he had this 2-page pitch, and boom, we were off. And it's we were sort of blessed ever since. You know, we got the BFI involved very early on. They funded the first few drafts of the scripts, and we got people like Invisible, the visual effects people, on board, and the whole thing just started snowballing. But the real... You know, the real turning point was getting Gillian Anderson and Ben Kingsley on board. Uh-huh. That it really got momentum after that.
Is that one of them situations where, you know, speaking of them two, which obviously, you know, people listening to a podcast like mine, I'm assuming are going to know the whole backstory of what they've been in.
Yeah.
Is that one of them situations where, you know, because people who listen to this podcast readily are aware that we're in pre-production on a web series right now. And it's one of them things of where, you know, you do acting for certain people, but then if Ben Kingsley walks in, you're suddenly like, I don't need to act anymore. I don't need to, or was it one of them things where, or I guess kind of that's my jokey question, but I guess there must be a serious reason why that happened.
We had an amazing casting director, a wonderful woman called Amy Hubbard. Mm-hmm. She just cast a little film called The Hobbit. Amongst
that
others.
Little thing,
yeah. So you know, it was clear they
never heard of it.
I mean, for a British independent film, we were punching above our weight, but yeah. It was clear that our budget was quite hefty, and
I was going to ask you about that, but you didn't. You don't need to tell me the numbers, but it says on Wikipedia it's 25 million.
Depending on which producer you ask and what day of the week it is, you'll get a different answer. I think it was somewhere between, and the 25 million is dollars on Wikipedia. I think it was somewhere between 7 and 9 million pounds.
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound a lot, but for a British independent movie, it is a lot of money.
Yeah, most definitely.
And a lot of that was spent on visual effects, wisely, I think, as well, because it's a very effects heavy movie, and it gave Invisible the time. To do the job properly as well. It's when you're selling a movie, particularly internationally, you need to have international stars. So, I mean, John and I drew up a wish list of people, and Gillian and Sir Ben were at the top of the list, and we'll never get them. And I remember distinctly walking down Shaftesbury Avenue, and my phone went, and it was John. He said, we've got Gillian. I said, Gillian who? Gillian Anderson. And I just froze, because, you know, I'm a huge fan. I grew up watching The X-Files. I love it. Amazing
Ditto.
Show.
Ditto, yeah.
And she's done that thing of breaking away from a huge hit of a series and becoming an incredibly well-respected actor in her own right, you know. And She was great in it. She's just terrific. I think what attracted her was she'd never played a mum before. You know, she plays the cop or the agent kicking down the door and waving a gun around or whatever. And she also felt it was something that her boys would enjoy, and they did. They did actually. Funny enough, it was at the MCM in London where she said that, you know, she sat down with the boys to watch it and they absolutely loved it.
Great,
which is great.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Yeah. So how? So what was the situation with Ben? Because I imagine, you know, he's went through a period of time where obviously he's played the bad guys and a lot of stuff. So what was the pitch to him to get him to play?
Well, what was lovely is that whenever he speaks about the film, he talks about it in those kind of mythical Joseph Campbell tones, if you like. Okay. And that's great because John and I did so much of that when we were writing the script. We talked about the hero's journey and the archetypes that you meet and, you know, the beats of the story. And he totally latched onto all of that. And he said, you know, that Sean, the hero of a story, is like, you know, the prince looking for the missing king, his father. And,
yeah.
You know, the robots are like dragons, mythical creatures.
Yeah, and I got that, yeah.
It was great. He really latched onto that. And the reason he's such a star and such a great actor is he totally commits. He's, you know, this is, you know, it's a fun film about a robot occupation for kids, you know, of all ages.
Yeah.
But he totally commits to it. He's not winking at the camera at all. He's playing it for real.
Mm.
And that character, Mr. Smythe, you know, the geography teacher turned collaborator. I mean, we knew kids would love to hate that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew it too. And he just knocked it out of the park. Mm-hmm. Just knocks it out of the park.
There's something as well which, again, I'm surprised he managed to pull off, and I'm not just saying this because people who listen to this podcast are aware of how honest I am. Like, I would never have thought a northern accent done in that manner would be considered like evil. Like it works. You know, like so you kind of think when if you said to someone on a draft, oh, there's going to be this bad guy in a film and he's going to do a northern accent and that's going to add more terror. I would go. It's almost like the David Prowse Star Wars thing all over and over again. Yeah. But no, he really did a good job, and it was really convincing.
Well, he's from.
I've just realised I'm critiquing Ben Kingsley.
I'm sure he's.
Stephen
sure
has he's, a problem with him. Yeah.
I'm sure he's taking notes now.
I know. Yeah.
he's from that area. I think he's from Skipton.
Yeah, yeah. He might be. Yeah, yeah.
And he said in interviews that it was kind of based on a teacher at his school when he was growing up. Well, I mean, we never wrote it that way. We never had, you know, Huddersfield accent in the brackets, you know. But I remember after the first night, I rang John and said, how'd it go? How's the first night? Oh, it's great. I said, how was Sir Ben? Oh, he's fantastic. He said, he's doing it with a Huddersfield accent.
We're doomed.
okay. He said, but don't worry. It's a good one. It's a good one.
It is really good.
And it's funny, you look back at the script and the number of times he refers to the children, particularly the boys, you know, lad and son, and it's just it does lend itself to that kind of region. Mm. You know, it could easily be very Cockney as well, but yeah, again, that's the thing of an actor bringing something out of the blue. The thing I've learned throughout this is film is collaborative, and if you get great people, they're just going to make you look better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he was terrific.
Mm. I think, as you pointed out, because we were saying about, you know, him playing a lot of bad roles, I think he's the greatest example of this. And it's kind of the way that I think bad, whenever an actor's playing the baddie in a film, you know, it's like obviously the late great Alan Rickman, who died recently, he's a perfect example, is they have to have the mindset of that they're right and everyone else is wrong, which is what you were talking about just before.
Yeah, and that's something we wanted to make clear in the script. I mean, and it's something I explore more in the book as well, which is Smythe thinks he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
It's like the robots here, they're a fact of life. If you fight them, we've seen them drop planes out of the sky. We've seen them lay waste to cities. How on earth can you combat that? Mm. Let's work with them. We'll work with them, and we can keep the water running, the heat on, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's how he rationalizes what he does.
Yeah.
And, you know, to a certain extent, he's right. But then, you know, he ends up killing people.
And, yeah, the consequences, know. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, it crosses a line.
But yeah, okay, well, I think this is a perfect time to delve into that, because that's what I wanted to talk to you about. Because there's several things that, you know, I want to say what I thought, and then let's see whether that's how it was intended. Is because you touched on one. I totally agree with you with the idea of that it felt like, you know, like you see a prince trying to find a king, or that's really what it felt like with Sean. I really do agree with you on that. It also, towards the end of whether you think, it had a kind of like Neo aspect to it, as in Matrix. It was like, because of the connections with the robots at the end, where he tells them all to leave, which is kind of similar to Neo, like having a virus, sending a virus. But was it kind of, you know, let's stick with Ben's character, were you exploring with that particular character the idea of sort of self, like a survival instinct and a person, because that was, you know, that's really ultimately what all his decisions were based on, like, because it was revealed later in the film, spoiler alert for those that want to watch it who haven't seen it, but he's doing it because he's being offered a chance to get his own, like, land, in Tasmania, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah.
And, which is bizarre.
we figured there's a whole... The trouble with the film is, you know, and it's something the book, I wanted to address with the book, is that John and I, there's so much backstory to this.
Yes.
That the film only really skims the surface. Mm-hmm. So there are references to things like Australia apparently is empty. You know, mm-hmm. everyone in Australia has already been processed. They're all dead. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of land. And so the robots have said to all the collaborators, and we Googled 10 most beautiful places on Earth. And this place, is it Mount St. Clair in Tasmania? And it is gorgeous. It looks paradise on Earth. It's about choices. People make choices in difficult positions, and it's an occupation movie, and we, you know, the British turn their noses up at collaborators in France and whatever and say, oh, that wouldn't happen here. It would so happen here. It's just human nature. There will be people who resist, people who collaborate, people who pretend it's not happening, and that was something we explored through all the characters. You know, there are some who have just had enough, like the father at the beginning, who says, I can't take it anymore, kill me now. To people who are like Sean, our hero, who is single-minded in he is determined that there has to be a happy ending to this, and that his father will sort it out. But when he finds his father, he finds the fight has gone all out of him, and that was a big thing for John and I, because we've, you know, both got fathers that we love very much, but there comes a point in any boy's life when he realizes his father is just a human being. He's not always going to be there, and that's when you realize I have to grow up and look after myself. And that's something we wanted to explore in the film as well. So it's
that's always a good story. It's something like I'm 28 now, and I'm sort of. It's one of the things you realize, like, you know, your parents make mistakes, like any human being does. But it's not just the idea of looking at them always to do the right thing as well, but it's also letting go of the wrong things that they do as well. Is something I'm learning in life. Not that, you know, I've learned it over a process of time, but I'm more and more understanding, you know, when you start, especially when you get more responsible as you get older, that's something that happens all the time, and it's just, you can't resent them for not doing good decisions all the time, because they don't.
The parents was something we went around on again and again and again, because in very early drafts of the story, the dad was actually on the journey with his son.
Yeah.
It was just him, it was father and son.
Oh, okay.
Looking for Gillian Anderson's character.
Okay.
And what we discovered was it just sucked all the excitement out of it, because no responsible parent would put their child in that dangerous position.
Yeah.
And it just made his dad look like an idiot. And which is why in so many classic stories, Roald Dahl stories, myths and everything, the parents are either absent or dead or left behind, you know, because it's about the young going into the deep dark woods, encountering a wolf and having to survive on their own. And that's the story that we wanted, which we found, really, is that it was about children going out into a very dangerous world and having to survive on their own, and ultimately struggling, really struggling with it. And but then finding when they found the grown-ups, when they thought the grown-ups would come in, and solve everything that they weren't up to it, and it was up to the kids to sort of take care of it themselves.
Yeah, like a coming of age thing, yeah.
And if you're 11 years old,
yeah,
that plays on a fantasy, which is, you know, if I was running the world, I would do it this way. And certainly at test screenings, that's what kids love. They really, really enjoyed it. I mean, yeah. I remember a friend of mine who came to see it with her daughter said to her, what did you think? She said, it was great. It was like Doctor Who, but without the doctor to rescue them. It was just a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for British kids especially, if they're a certain age, 11, 12 years old, they're too young to have seen Harry Potter at the cinema.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For them, this was the first time they're seeing British kids having a big widescreen genre adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And they just projected themselves onto those characters and had a really good time.
That's a very fascinating metaphor you just did, because I agree. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, if you watch something like Doctor Who, I think the problem is, great as Doctor Who's made now, the problem with it, like you just touched on, is no matter what bad shit goes down, the Doctor will find a way of solving it some way. Whereas
Electronic screwdriver.
There'll be an attachment that'll find some way of. Yeah, and so as great as an episode can be, it's almost like, well, you're almost waiting for them to get out of it. Whereas, yeah, to your point, what's in the film in particular, what's made very obvious at the beginning, as Mark just described, is the opening scene where the father says he's had enough, and it's a derelict area, and you and there's robots everywhere. So you're aware of that it's like a very hopeless situation, and there's no easy fix.
What's interesting about that scene is that was originally about 10 minutes in the movie, and that's how it was in the script. We did all this kind of world building to start with, establishing the world, and then we had someone die, and that kind of kicked off the story.
Yeah.
And something about the beginning wasn't working, and John and his editor, Matt Platt Mills, who's a great editor, were going back and forth on it. The producers were looking at it. We couldn't figure it out. So for a couple of weeks, they brought in a brilliant editor, a chap called Mick Audsley, who's, if you look him up on IMDb, I mean, it's incredible what he's done. Most recently, he worked on Everest, the film, not the mountain.
Yeah.
And
he came in and said...
Why don't you open with the dad being killed? And we're like, well, this is, you know, the script is meticulously. If you start breaking, anyway, we did it. It was bloody brilliant.
Yeah.
People watch, kids especially watch the film, and they see that and they suddenly sit up. And people die in this. And people die like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it upped the stakes immediately. And you knew stepping outside was a big deal. So when Milo Parker's character is running across the street, there's a robot chasing after him. You're like, get inside!
Yeah, yeah.
You could see people getting like that. So,
it's funny. I was just about to say, as I was watching this a few days ago, and I was sitting watching it. The opening scene with the father. I'll just tell you my thought process while I was sitting watching it. I was expecting him to not die. That's right. Probably because of all the films you've seen where there's that type of scene where you go, no, they're going to survive, they're going to be fine. That I swear to you, I was sitting there going, he's not really going to die. It's going to be one of them things where I know he gets vaporized, and you're like, good. I'm glad to see we're sticking to, no, really, the world's in trouble. And which I like that you did that, yeah, because it gone against my instinct. But again, it's not necessarily your fault. It's just the. In terms of what I originally thought, there's too many films that do that. You know, the whole Star Trek of if the main crew go down to the planet, they're not going to die. That type of that type of feeling. But what I wanted to ask you, because you touched on this, and this is one of the questions I thought of in the build up to doing this podcast, is when I touched on earlier that I assumed that you'd done the book first and then the film, but you didn't. It was the other way around. That leads to some interesting discussion, which I want to get to, because the whole reason that it's better doing it that way, as I'm sure you'll agree, is that you've got a whole backstory of stuff, and then you kind of, you know, like you mentioned The Hobbit earlier, like, you know, it's a book that's already established, so you pick and choose which film you want to do, and then, like, sort of fit it to whatever length you want it to be and what story you want to tell. Whereas the other way around means that it sounds like, from what you were saying earlier, that you were writing something and then you had to go, we need to stop this because it's an hour and a half film. Is that fair to say, and how difficult was that for you to do as a writer?
I don't know if one way is better than the other. I mean, many, many good books have been made into good films. Many terrible books have been made into good films.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, I also grew up in the 80s reading really good, fun tie-in novelizations. You know, the Donald F. Glut novelization of The Empire Strikes Back, where you first learn, you know, all this stuff about Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda and that isn't in the film. In the Return of the Jedi novelization, you first hear about Vader and Obi-Wan fighting in a pool of lava. You know, it's so this that I just love being, especially being a geeky fan, reading those and having that little nugget of knowledge that the average fan on the street didn't have.
Yeah.
It took us at least a couple of years to get a really good draft of the script together, because so much of it was world building and making sure the world worked. But what you don't want to do in a film is start showing you're working, you know?
Yeah.
Calculations. Exactly. Yeah. It's look how clever we are. We thought of all of this. Mm. And it's frustrating in a way, because you sometimes see people criticizing, saying, well, how is electricity running? How is their food? Blah. We thought of all of that.
Yeah.
All of it. And it's all, I mean, I go into it in some detail in the book, but even in a book, you don't want to bore people to death with that. You just want to reassure them that this is a working world where these things have been thought of. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we went back and forth on this stuff a lot.
Would it be fair to say it, the part of the problem as well as thinking about how all them are going to work in a film format, is means you're going to spend more time focusing on that than you're going to never finish a script then? That's how I would look at that.
Well, I mean, it was always about the story for us, the story and the characters, but the world that they live in, there are rules. You've got to establish rules, what works and what doesn't, how far you're going to push it. The tone is very important as well. But, you know, it's funny. I mean, John and I are literally just finishing a script, a horror script, which, again, has very specific rules. And the thing we've learned, I think, from Robot Overlords is actually you don't need to sweat this stuff. As long as we know and the characters know, you don't have to sit and explain it to the audience. The audience is pretty smart. They catch up really, really quickly. So, you know, the script we're working on now, we've spent the last, you know, few months just streamlining, whittling away at the exposition that you kind of think, oh, we really need to get that point across, but actually the story does it itself if you have faith in the story and the characters.
Mm-hmm. So what originally got you, I know you touched on this a little bit earlier, but what specifically about robots appealed, and how did you come up with the idea of that they were, because I quite like the idea of that, because I don't know whether or not you read the story I read about. It's kind of one of the things that they debunk about aliens actually coming to the planet, because they would be actually like intelligent and curious about who we are if they had never came before, which is something you actually made your alien race being like, that they were actually curious about us and actually wanted to experiment on us, which it's not like the aliens that end up in trailer parks where they're like, no, we want to take you to our planet, and which is, makes no sense at all. So I'm just intrigued to know how you got to that point.
Well, we wanted it to be credible. We wanted it to be scary. The thing with robots is, being mechanical, they can travel great distances. They're very, very patient as well. So they can wait. You know, it's just a line in the film that's explained more in the book. They plan to be here for 7 years. They have everything sort of mapped out, what they want to do. They are data miners. So they are looking, they're basically looking through everyone's minds, looking for any nugget of information. And again, it's something that was cut from the film, but it's in the book, where they say, like, a child's playground game on one planet gave them a strategy to win a war on another planet. That something from the mind of a botanist on this world gave them a concoction for a poison gas to help them win a battle on another planet. So, you know, it's the thing of scooping up data. And for me, that was a very modern theme as well, with people like Google and Amazon scooping up every bit of data about you.
Exactly.
And without being overt about it, you know, we thought that might strike a chord for people. And it has. It definitely has. Mm-hmm. People have seen that and latched onto it. So, you know, they're cold, they're forbidding, we made our robots very, very functional. There were more robots in the original sort of pitch document that we had. That there was like a speeder robot that was essentially just a wheel mm-hmm. with guns on the side. The sniper that you see in the film is essentially just a gun with crab-like legs. The cube is a giant power source, so mm-hmm. it's like a giant battery floating through the sky. The skyship looks like a giant brick because it doesn't need to be aerodynamic. So, you know, the Sentry, we gave a lot of thought to it. You'll notice that it's got this, you know, it's got a tiny, tiny head.
Yeah, yeah.
But big muscles and...
Let me just look at my notes.
Yes. Well, the idea behind that was they studied us for years before mm-hmm. they invaded, and they realized that we were frightened of people with tiny brains and big muscles. That was an instinctive fear for all of us. Conversely... Mm-hmm. We react well to children. We're less likely to harm children. Mm. So that's why they send this creepy child robot, the Mediator, played by Craig in the film, who is supposed to, you know, warm the cockles of our hearts. Of course, they get that a little bit wrong. He's actually the most terrifying thing in the whole film.
I agree, When he first walks in that scene halfway through, I'm like, I'm actually freaked out because, like, he's not... You hear him, but you don't see him until he walks into, like, the light. And I'm like, God, it is quite an eerie... scene, most definitely.
What you discover in the book is that his voice is made up of the voices of billions of people that have already been data scanned by the robots. Okay. So a syllable here, a word there, you know. Yeah. It's all, so he has this incredibly creepy voice of dead people as well.
So how involved, like, because this is what I wanted to get to, because we obviously talked about the cast and whatnot, and I definitely want to mention the young actors that were in
yes.
it, because they were brilliant in it. And we'll get to that in a second. But I just wanted to ask you in terms of... So once you knew you were making the film, how involved were you and your co-writer in the process?
John is... I'm lucky in that John, the co-writer, is also the director. Mm-hmm. And we've built up a good professional relationship and we trust each other. And he was great at bringing me in to be a second opinion, you know. So I wasn't there through all the casting, but when they got down to the final few, he'd asked what I thought of you know, this person or that person.
Nice.
You know, so he was very... Where I have no expertise, like production design or costume design or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, then...
Didn't care, really.
No, but I would see, while I was working on drafts, I'd occasionally get an email with... some of the concept art by people like Jack Dubman, you know, and mm-hmm. It was just incredible and just inspirational as well.
Yeah.
You know, you'd look at this stuff and you'd just be, you know, if you're having a bad day on rewrites and you'd see something come in with these guys, you'd just, it'd just put, you know, give you wings. And, you know, there were all sorts of different designs, and we go back and forth on what worked and what didn't and stuff like that. So I was able to chip in, which was great. And you hear horror stories from other writers where that's not the case. And that was right through the edit as well. Mm-hmm. So I was able to come into the edit suite, see work in progress, give my opinion on it. We were rewriting bits of dialogue during the edit as well, just to, you know, where something wasn't clear or... so, you know, it was a very collaborative process. The thing I'm realizing now from talking to other writers, I've been spoiled rotten on this film. I don't think many writers get the kind of access that I did. So
that's kind of why I guess that was kind of why I'm asking, because I have had the good fortune of speaking to some writers who have been on screenplays and they've wrote a screenplay and then it gets edited and it's not what they wrote and various other things. So I guess, yeah, it must be a huge help that the person you wrote it with, the guy directing it as well, because he has the final, at least some sort of say, maybe not the final say on everything, but...
Well, the other thing is a director has to understand the purpose of the scene.
Yeah, indeed,
And what it's for. And if he's written it, then he's going to know that. Whereas you might have a director who's doing a scene and he just might not understand why it's there, why that character says that particular thing. And... it might get missed, it might get fluffed, and, you know, it's not until you see the finished film sometimes you think, oh, that could have been a bit better, that could have changed, you know. Little beats, little moments. Usually it's not the dialogue, actually, it's little looks between characters or whatever, and, you know, John and I put those beats in there, he knew them, he'd marked them with a, you know, with a flag, and they'd be in the storyboard, and they would get shot, and they'd be in the scene.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I always say this about, I have a lot of creative people who have been on this podcast. This is episode 102, and that seems to be a common thing of that, like, this perfectionist feeling that creative people get where they just wish, oh, I wish that would have been, you know, you look at it in post and stuff. So I think that's just a common reaction, really. But
It's your name on the credits or on the cover of the book or whatever piece of, whatever thing you're creating. So, you know, it needs to be as good as it can be. I'm not talking about perfection. I don't think you'll ever get perfection. And the other thing is, you have to, particularly in filmmaking, it's collaborative. You know, people are going to have better ideas.
Of course.
And you have to take that. The actors, the production designers, all members of the crew, all good ideas are welcome, you know. Mm-hmm. And they'll all come in with little ideas that will change things. I remember walking around the set and looking at the set of Sean's apartment and house, and because they knocked the wall through and it's next door as well, and just looking at all the details, there were plants in old baked bean tins, just all these little details and touches that, as I was walking around, I thought, I'm nicking this for the book, definitely, you know. So genius little touches that I loved, and it just adds to the texture and the complexity of the world, you know.
Oh, of course. I mean, in all the stuff that I've been involved in, I've been in a few productions, and obviously I'm running this company right now, and it is so much nicer to have it's great to have a second opinion on something, because you can be so convinced that it's the right way to do something, and then someone goes, have you ever thought about doing it this way? And all of a sudden you just go, yeah, that's far, far better. That happened when we were at MCM with Wayne, where we were doing some outside shooting, and you know, occasionally I would come up with something that was better than what we came up with, but then he would say, have you thought about doing it this way? And it's just so nice to get an outward perspective on things, because you can sometimes be so involved that you don't know, you can't figure out what's right.
It's one of the reasons at the back of the book are the full credits.
Let me look at my notes. This is going to be a common occurrence. Yeah.
All the cast and crew.
Well, I never realised this.
I just wanted to acknowledge that all these people made a contribution.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing.
To making the film.
It's almost like it's when you see certain like Kickstarter projects where they write down everyone that's, which is kind of what it's like. Yeah, it's
all of these people made a contribution.
Wow, fantastic! So. I encourage people to obviously buy the book, and you can obviously look at this. But yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, and special thanks to all these people who. Yeah. Woohoo! That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. When you go on a set as well, I remember we had a week's rehearsal with the kids before we started shooting, and I'm walking around looking at all these props and set designs and everything, and I'm thinking, all this because of something John and I cooked up.
That must be pretty amazing.
Countless cups of tea and, you know.
I feel does it make a difference how much that you're your money you're being given, or it doesn't? Because I was just thinking as you said that, you know, I get that feeling no matter how much money's put into it, whether it's £500 or £1 million, you know, it's like I love that regardless. But does the money make you feel any different?
You feel valued.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the problems of the British film industry is writers are expected to work for free. Well, any film industry, writers seem to be expected to work for free.
Yeah.
Or do free rewrites, or whereas this, you know, it's if you're paid, you feel valued. So it kind of does, to be honest.
I can imagine. Yeah, no, you made a very good point. You made me just reminded me. Yeah.
This being the British film industry, it's not. I do events at schools. I talk about screenwriting for children, and do a little, sort of hero's journey workshop. And we, you know, there are questions at the end, and kids will always go, are you rich? No, mate.
It's the same whenever you do, like, sort of, I've not done very many of these, but occasionally, like, my school a while ago did this thing where, like, my old high school did this thing of, oh, anyone who's ever done any, like, sort of interesting, like, jobs, like, done anything, like, different that we'd like to know what you've done. So it's kind of like a catch up with people. So they sent me an email saying like, oh, we've looked at what you're up to and that sounds really cool, so if you could give us like a thing. And I did do one particular example of that, and yeah, it is kind of weird that that's, no matter what you say, you could go, oh, I'm having the greatest time of my life, I'm feel fulfilled in my life, and like, but how much money do you have? Like, it's literally the first.
Well, you know, I mean, my children, my daughter's 16, my son's nearly 14, and they're he's my son's having all these careers lessons at the moment, and you know he's starting to think about that stuff. You know, if he can earn a living, he's discovered that there is such a thing as a games tester. His career teacher, you know, I can just play games all the time and earn $40,000 a year. So you know he's very excited about that.
Well, if he, I hope he sticks with that feeling, because I think my response to that is I think boys always go through that period of time where they would love to do that, because I remember being roughly that age going, yeah, I would love to do that too, but it's a very hard thing to do and get done for it. But yeah, I just wanted to end the thought about what you were saying, because I thought your answer was a very good one, that the idea of that, yeah, writers don't usually get the privilege of being able to do, you know, to do what you were saying, because there's another example of that on this podcast where I spoke to a guy called Paul Gerard, who's a concept designer, and he did a bunch of, like, he worked on the last Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film, he worked on the Wrath of the Titans and the Clash of the Titans and a bunch of other stuff, and he was telling me, and it's funny, I had an argument with one of my best friends about this last week, because he's going, because about a web series, and I've said that the web series we're doing is very low budget, and he's going, are you able to pay everybody? And I'm like, it's a low budget. And he's like, well, and then when you hear stories from, like, yourself, where you do a screen, you do a play, which, I mean, you do a screenplay which turns into a film, which is worth, which has been £8 million or whatever the right amount is. And then you hear Paul Gerard, who's been on, like, who's telling me he's been on several blockbuster stuff, and how concept designing works as an artist would, he would say, they would get you to sketch a particular character, like, for argument's sake, he actually did get this through. His Shredder is used in the last Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but he was telling me that he was up against 8 other artists, and they basically get them to sign. They get them to draw their idea, and they don't get paid to draw their idea. They only get paid about, the only person that gets paid is the one that gets picked.
Yeah, you get that with pitches. I mean, I'm pitching to just for Christmas, I put together a very extensive sort of 15 page pitch for a film idea, and I know it's a beauty contest. I know there's going to be every writer in town will be pitching for this project, and you have to do that little dance for them. And it is frustrating. I mean, from their point of view, they obviously don't have a bottomless pit of development money. So you can take it so far, but if they were to come back and say, do a draft, but we're not going to pay you, then we have to part ways. But yeah, it's all too common, I'm afraid. And there are a lot of what they call, you know, cappuccino producers who go to all the coffee bars in Soho and get you to write scripts that they'll take to Cannes and try and sell on a, you know, wing and a prayer, but they're not actually paying anyone. And it's... You know, if you can't be in the business of paying people, then don't be in business.
Indeed,
I appreciate where you've got something like yourself where it's mega, mega low budget, perhaps, and you're doing it for fun and, you know, experience and something that's good in your CV. But I think once you're dealing with professional producers who have access to funds and development funds, there should be really no excuse.
Well, as I say, it's not necessarily, I guess the point I was making to my friend at the time was that it wasn't a case of that I wasn't paying them. I was just saying I was paying them in the grounds of what it is my point I was getting to. And he had this, there's certain people of which I think why it's important having a discussion like we are now, where I think there's people in the general public who don't necessarily work in this industry or have never worked in it or have never been behind the scenes of any something like this, that think you all get paid the same amount regardless of, what it is that you do. And that's basically the point I'm making. I 100% agree with you that no matter what, you know, I've said to people making this web series because we're going to kickstart for some of the money, and one of the things that I've said to them, the people who are involved in it right now, if we don't get the money to pay everybody to be on it, I'm not going to do it. Because I've been, you know, like, especially, you know, when you first start out doing any productions or being an actor, like you were just touching on earlier on the shows, that, yeah, you do end up doing stuff far too much for free. And one of the things I would say to people all the time is always be wary of if you become the person that is, like, doing an internship or an apprentice for years and not having the balls to say, I actually want to be paid now, because there's such a thing as people taking advantage of you going, but it's a good opportunity. Like,
the exposure argument. Great exposure. No, fuck you.
Exactly. We do reach a point where, I've reached that point now where I will maybe the odd occasion I'll do something because I go, I understand that the project is something where, and it's not, if it doesn't take up a great deal of my time, I will do it in that sense. But for 99% of the time, if someone wants me to do something that takes up something else that's away from this, which is my main focus, then yeah, I need to be substantiated for that, and the only way that can happen is by giving me the money to do, be able to do that. Like, really,
just, if you're a writer starting out, just appreciate that what you do has a value.
Yes,
okay, and it's the beginning of the project. Without your writing, no one would get paid.
Mm-hmm.
No one would have a job. So mm-hmm. what you have has an incredible value, and as long as you value yourself, then yeah, then you'll, I mean, it'll be hard. I'm not making out it's going to be easier whatsoever, and I'm you know, it's still hard for, I know lots of writers who still have day jobs. I still have a day job.
Yeah.
But just remember that what you do has a value. Be brave enough to say no.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's not right for whatever reason. Yeah.
I mean, it's natural. If someone comes along and says, great, I want to make your movie, wonderful, they are going to give you an option of £1, but you know, there's a back end deal. I've had this.
I'm laughing because I've heard that so many times.
There's an amazing back end deal, and if it makes millions, and I'll quote some film that did this once in the past, like, I don't know, Blair Witch Project or whatever. And the best thing you can say then is no, because while you say no, you still have all the power. You still hold all the cards.
Totally agree with you.
The minute you say yes, the balance of power shifts to them.
Indeed.
Which is great if it's a proper producer with access to funds and you know, the people who get your film made. And that's something you have to understand with scripts as well. Once they've bought the rights to your script, it's no longer your script.
Indeed.
It's their script.
What I was about to say. In terms of, I've told this story on the podcast before, so I'm going to be boring people who listen to this, but. Just for the benefit of Mark, there was a story, the story I told, this was in the first year of me doing Geek Apocalypse, and I got given an offer behind the scenes of getting what I thought was an advertising deal, because we obviously say to people we would advertise if people want us to, and they gave me a deal, and it was a decent amount of money, and so I went, okay, well, I'm willing to talk about this, obviously, this would be great, and... You know, I basically said to them, yeah, we would give you like a minute. I would do like a minute at the beginning where I would say what the product was or whatever it may be, and we'll talk about what you want me to say, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it only was when you get into the process like that that you realize that it wasn't what they originally intended it to be. And it essentially became a thing of, no, we're buying your idea. Essentially, that's what it ended up feeling like. And the reason I'm bringing this up to what we're just talking about, because it's so similar to me, is that the one thing that you have, whether it be writing or doing this or whatever, the content you create is the thing that you that is most valuable to you. So the minute you pass that power away, you've lost all negotiation tool, you've lost all marketability, you've lost all focus, really. So you've got to be very, very careful about that.
But you go in with your eyes open. Mm-hmm. And be a grown up about it, then I mean, the fact is, you will have to, if you want it to get made, you will have to sign it over at one point. You can be fired from your own project. You know, there was a point where we had a major studio interested in Robot Overlords at one point.
Okay.
And John and I sat down, and you know, I had not, this was, I've written many, many scripts, but this was my first script going into production. So in their eyes, I had zero experience. And what they would do, if the budget suddenly rocketed up to 50 million or more, of course they'd fire me and they'd bring in someone they know as, say,
John Logan.
You know, Simon Kinberg or someone like that, you know. But so that was, you know, we both come up with the idea and blah, 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 and it's our baby and everything, but... The producers, the production company, now owns that intellectual property.
Mm.
And they can do whatever they want with it.
So, yeah, totally.
So if you go in with your eyes open, and you're fairly recompensed for that, then we're all grown-ups, and that's fine.
I mean, I guess the key distinction with this is something that, you know, I guess that particular example I gave with me is that it's like a podcast I do every week, which I've done for a while, and it's like it's a slightly different thing as opposed to... something that, like a film that may be done for an hour and a half, and you may not do another film, for example. So it's obviously dependent on what you're selling. But yes, I get your point. If you eventually, you know, which we have done for certain things, like, you are giving away something to get that back. It can't just be nothing. But yeah, so I take your point on board.
So for your podcast, for example, there'll be you'd essentially be selling the format and the name, Geek Apocalypse, and then you know, that's whoever has that can then run off and they can make it into a TV show, a game show, a radio show, whatever they want. But you would, you know, if you got a decent deal out of that, that could actually make you a very rich man.
Yeah, if I wanted it to be. Yeah, sure. Of course, yeah. But which is the decision you always have to make, yeah.
It's that Wayne's World decision, that Wayne's World dilemma. Do you sell out to the corporation? And you know, sometimes that's a good thing. It frees you up to do other things that you love. If that gives you the financial freedom to go off and make something else, then great.
Yeah, but I mean, but that particular deal just wasn't worthwhile.
No,
but
sure.
Yeah, but I see your point. But anyway, yeah. So there's another thing. When you told me about the credits at the end of your book, it got me reminded me of something I wanted to ask you as well, which was this in relation to the fact that it was just someone? It was the Isle of Man? Was it that was an Isle of Man? Produced it, did they? There was a company.
Yeah, the Isle of Man have
Isle of Man film.
It's very complicated, but they have a relationship with Pinewood Studios.
Yeah, it's just written here.
And Northern Ireland Film as well got involved. John had made Grabbers in Northern Ireland, had a very good experience. Of course, it's where they make Game of Thrones, so they have really great crews there. Great extras, as we discovered as well, they all know each other. They all have a shorthand. So if you're on a fairly tight budget, that's great, because time really is money on a film set. And if these guys can rattle along and keep motoring, then that's great. That's saving you money. And the Isle of Man deal, I mean, we have something like 14 producers on the film. You know, each one chipping in funding or sort of funding in kind. It's all very... I would never be a producer. It's so complicated. Such a thankless, complicated task.
I've done that a few times for BBC productions and whatnot. And it is, as you said, a thankless job. Yeah. It's the worst job because... It's not the worst job. It can be very fulfilling because it's not a role where you feel like you're not an important role, because it's a very important
it's a crucial
job.
But
you're
not the
you don't make decisions. Yeah,
no. And if you stop 10 people in the street, I doubt any of them could name a producer who wasn't
indeed
a director.
Yeah.
So it's
exactly because you say to someone, oh, I worked on this BBC production, what do you do? Oh, I was like a production assistant, or I was a producer or a co-producer or a associate producer, and they go,
they don't know what that is.
Yeah, they were like, I don't, yeah, is that the same as makeup?
Well, they I mean, there's the sort of stereotypical image of the Hollywood producer with the chomping on a cigar, you know. But that's not, I mean, someone like Piers, our producer, the magnificent Piers Tempest, that's his real name. He was just tireless. From the second he optioned it, he was just constantly banging the drum and flying the flag for us and getting people on board, because he knew it was a great idea and he knew we could write a good script and he knew we could make a really good fun film. And that doesn't let up, you know, from the minute he's optioned it all the way through post-production, through the release. Still now, you know, he's doing stuff for us in the film, and it is a relationship with a film. It's like a startup business, and in 10, maybe even 20 years, there'll still be Piers will still have dealings with Robot Overlords as an entity, you know, with funds coming in from here, there, if there are TV shows or sequels or other, you know, elements to it, especially. So it's, and it's one of the reasons why it's now so difficult to get something off the ground is, you know, a producer has to be sure that they want to live with this thing for the rest of their lives.
Indeed, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's tough. I appreciate it.
And if you work on something that's not like yours, as you say, if you're a producer that's hired on someone else's work, and you've got to, like, it does help if you like the thing that you're involved in.
Yeah,
as you were saying, yeah, you're quite right. But you know, I have enjoyed the production stuff that I've been involved in, but It is a thankless role, and it make you know if you've finished on a project, you are absolutely exhausted because it's just you never stop. Because your role just is just I'm trying to remember what the famous quote was about producers. Aren't producers just a Hollywood's version of a secretary, and they're the ones who get everyone together or something like that? I can't remember what the quote was, but maybe
there's all sorts of different producers as well. Yeah. There are creative producers who are very involved with the creative process from the very beginning.
Yeah, of course.
There are those who are very, very hands off, who are more about assembling a great team for the task. Mm-hmm. There are those who are, you know, you have line producers who are more, you know, who go from project to project to project, who are the ones who actually do the logistics and make everything work, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's, I'm in awe of them.
Totally. And I can imagine it sounded like a very good process. You reminded me of when you spoke about your editor earlier on. I watched once Tarantino lost his longtime collaborator.
Sally Menke.
And he was talking about the new one that he had. I saw him on Howard Stern talking about this, where he was saying that she was almost like a co-director, co-writer, in the sense of that his editor was really involved.
They say you write your movie three times. There's once on paper, second time on the set, and the third time in the edit.
Yeah,
which is why I was so glad I was there during the edit, because it is one of the most creative parts of the process. It's one of the things you learn as a writer in production is you spend years with sheets of paper, which is a script, but the minute that scene is shot, the paper is irrelevant. Mm. It's now a living, breathing thing on a screen that isn't an exact replication of what you put on paper and will be different for better, for worse, but that's what you've got now. It's no longer in your head, it's now on a screen, and you now have to work with that. Mm-hmm. And that's a lesson, you know, you have to learn pretty quickly.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, okay, so a couple of more things. Obviously, I've had you for a while, so I just want a couple more questions, because as we said, I would not want to not mention the... because I wanted to open the question about the young actors involved.
Yeah.
Because we were touching on that, and I was very, very impressed. And I wanted to ask you kind of jokingly, is the way I'm going to ask you it is... Was it like your version of Harry, Hermione, and Ron? in terms of the casting, were you thinking, I've got to get this right, these are my babies and I want them to be good? And
they had to they had to work as a team.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, we had to get it right. I mean, they're kind of based on my kids and how I was growing up. You know, there's one of the really gratifying things about some of the things people have said about the film and the book is the kids speak like real kids. Mm. And John and I look back at films like E.T. where Melissa Matheson had watched Harrison Ford's sons bickering and took that and put that in the beginning of E.T. Mm-hmm. And we wanted that real feel. So that scene when they're all arguing and there's just jokes, really inappropriate jokes, especially for a young kid like Milo, who's playing Connor. Yeah. He's only like 10 years old. Mm-hmm. That happens. Kids do that.
Yeah.
They tell each other really inappropriate jokes. And we wanted it to feel real. We wanted them to feel like a gang of mates. And that had to come across in the casting. So we were lucky in that we had a week's rehearsal with them before. Now, what's interesting is we had another actor cast as Nathan, who's played by James Tarpey in the film. We had another actor lined up, really good actor, very, very good, very comedic, very strong in improvisation, but he had a TV series on and he left. In retrospect, that might have been the best thing that happened to us, because James brought something to that little gang that just was magical. And it's something clicked with them all in place. This other guy would have been brilliant, but if anything, he might have been too much for the rest of the gang, whereas James just had the perfect touch. And we had a great week rehearsing with them, going through their lines in the script, because, you know, it's two guys in their 40s writing for teenagers, and they say, would you say that or would you say that? And they go, that's it. And we worked on that workshop stuff. We rehearsed scenes. And John was very clever on set in that he'd do a take off the script, word for word. Then he'd say, put it in your own words, just say what you'd normally say. And then a third take where it's a combination of both. And very often it was that third take where it had the essence of the script but also had a little bit of spontaneity that just brought it to life.
Yeah.
And some of the film's best moments have come out of that, you know, little bits of improv. And that's great because that means they take ownership of the characters. Again, it's getting it off the page and onto the screen.
I totally agree with you, and it's again that's something I've learned through a slow process of when I'm involved on the creative side. Is that it's funny as I was waiting to do this podcast, I had like half an hour, and I was doing a sort of working out the opening scene for the web series we're doing, and it's me on webcam doing like this monologue, and it's funny because I had the script on my screen. And I did that the three different ways you just said, and out of the three that I was watching back before I came to talk to you, was the one that I felt I did the best on was the one where I used some of the script, but I ad-libbed lines halfway through, which felt more like what my character would be, and it comes out in the acting as well, because it looks more spontaneous, because... You know, whenever you read something like as a conversation that a teenager or a person would say, you can see, or like as if that certain times you can see the person waiting to say the line, whereas if you ad lib, it's much more less likely that you're going to look that way, which
and
helps.
It's just, particularly with young people, you want a more relaxed performance. Mm. You don't want them kind of saying it by rote almost. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we had any, and they're just great across the board. They're great kids. And
were you pleased with Callan? I'm assuming you were, because I thought he was
brilliant.
Oh,
I love Callan. Yeah, I mean, it's he's got this great. You know, we wanted to write Sean as a cool character, kind of someone that
definitely was
the boys in the audience would want to be, and the girls in the audience would fancy. Was kind of the crude way of putting it, but
well,
it makes sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd write these lines, and we think that'd be a cool line. And then Callan comes up, and he's got this brilliant kind of 1,000-yard stare in his Pierce Brosnan voice. He said, we're gonna find my father. We're going to beat the robots. And, you know, wow, he's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, so it was very gratifying. And then Nathan, James as Nathan, he's just a brilliant improviser, very, very funny, knows great comic chops, really knows how to deliver a line. But also... you'll see behind that the fear that this kid has, because he's a serial bullshitter.
Yeah,
he gets found out at the end.
Yeah.
And he plays that balance great.
Mm.
Ella was terrific as Alex, and she kind of had probably the most difficult role, because she's a girl in a gang of boys.
Mm.
We didn't want her to be the wimpy girl. We wanted her to be... And the great... the thing I will confess is she had a brilliant action scene at the end of the film that got... cut. We never even shot it. It was just one of those things where the location for the end of the film was different on the original script, but we found this fantastic location, but it meant that we couldn't give her the ending that we wanted to give her. Mm. So, you know, there was it was a shame we had to lose that, but I think she's great in it. And funnily enough, the one, I mean, Milo, who plays Connor, who was 10 years old
brilliant.
At the time,
yeah,
never done, I think he'd done some acting at school, but never done any kind of professional stuff before. It's just amazing. And he's then gone on to work with Ian McKellen in Mr. Holmes. He was filming with Tim Burton over the summer. He's going to be in Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiars. He's playing the young Gerald Durrell in a TV series. He's been nominated for Best Newcomer about at least three times, like the Critics Circle, the LA Critics Circle. I mean, it's just, we're so... proud of what he's become, and he's a. I mean, this goes for all.
I was looking at
him. He's a really nice kid as well. You know?
That's even better. Yeah. He's the Edward Furlong of your film. I don't know if you can get that reference, but
well, yeah, no, I hope he doesn't end up like Edward.
No, not now. I mean, in pure. Good point. I meant purely on acting sense, because. I maintain for it, because the only reason I say that is because it reminded me, if you ever read about Edward Furlong, he literally got plucked out of class. And I think, I always say to people, I know, granted, yes, he's had a bad time since then, but I think for an actor who had very limited experience in that, I thought he did a phenomenal job in that.
Oh,
I mean,
terrific.
I mean, it may just be an action film, and as you'll say, a sci-fi film, but it doesn't mean that people don't have to act. I thought he did a great job. I just wanted to say, because I was actually on Milo's Wikipedia earlier, and there's someone's put a quote about Ian McKellen, and it just says Milo was full of the full of the spirit of a young person. He had no fear of the camera and knew exactly what the director wanted and required. I thought he was superb. So
yeah, he's terrific.
You know, if Ian McKellen says that, that's not a bad thing at all, is it?
Yeah, he's a natural. He's a natural, and
I thought he was great. From my opinion's worth, I thought he did a great job. But yeah, no, I honestly thought like the kind of young actors, dare I say, being with Gillian Anderson and Ben Kingsley are in it, but I thought they kind of stole the show, which I guess is
what
the
you
kind
expect
of point, really.
Them to be good. Yeah. You know, and there is, you know, child actors, it can be a bit hit and miss, and sometimes, you know, some will be better than others. But I think with our three, I just thought they worked really, really well. It's four, isn't it? Sorry, Callan. I tend not to think of Callan as one of the kids because he was kind of the oldest one.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, they just worked. They all had a role to play. They all worked and blended really, really well together, and they got on off screen as well. And I think that shows in the finished film.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you as well, just to wrap this up, is to say. Am I right in reading that there was an iPhone version of the film? Was there a game that got made for it?
There was a game. I believe it's still available. It's essentially a Temple Run kind of game.
Yeah.
And I'm rubbish at games, so I can't really give you a steer one way or the other on that. Okay, but that was something that was part of a Northern Ireland fund. I think it was it's a Northern Ireland games company that put it together, and I didn't really have anything to do with it. I did have a meeting with them because we talked about other games and other ideas for games and stuff like that. But it was
I do know that the game uses some of the film clips and stuff, so it is obviously based on it. But I don't know anything more than that, really.
I think when you turn it on, you get the trailer. And you do get the actual robots from the film in the game.
Okay.
And it's kind of a very fast-paced Temple Run thing, which I'm absolutely rubbish at.
Well, it's for those that don't know, just for people who may be interested, it's an iPhone type game. It's not a video game. It's I should have checked if it was on the iStore, but just type in Robot Overlord and I'm sure you'll find it. As far as I'm aware, it's still around.
I think the game is called Robot Warlords.
Oh, is it? It's called something different, okay.
For some strange rights or
copyright,
funding.
Copyright, maybe? Okay.
Yeah. No, I think it's something to do with funding. It's very...
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Ours is not true.
You might be right. As I say, I got told that there was a game version, so I just wanted to ask you about it. Is it true about the rumours about them being a television series?
There is a television series... sort of in development. We've got a brilliant showrunner, a writer called Chris Lunt, who's written shows like Prey, which is a BAFTA nominated TV show. What was very strange is John and I met Chris, and Chris had to pitch his idea to us because we've got zero experience in television. No one's ever going to give us a TV show to run. But we kind of, you know, contractually we have to give it the nod. And I was in this bizarre situation where a writer, BAFTA award nominated writer, you know, pitching to me. And luckily, it's fantastic. The idea he's got, I can't say anything about it, but he's got a really, really good take on it. It's going to take the show and the mythology to a different place. Where we are with it, I don't know. It's kind of on. I know he was away for Christmas with his family. Of course, everything shuts down over Christmas. So I know that there was a pilot script, and I read a version of that, which I really, really liked. And if it does kick off, then hopefully John and I will be involved as well.
Fantastic.
And I really would like to be, because I think it's got real potential.
Well, honestly, I wasn't really asking in a sense of finding out more. I just was more on the avenue of, I just was asking you if you were happy that, you know, if you're happy about it being made and how much you knew. It sounds like you are, which is excellent.
And I'd say that's
a very good writer.
Yeah, it's terrific. I mean, there was talk of a sequel, and John and I began work on a sequel, but it became clear they wanted to make it with the same kind of budget, and we wanted to go bigger.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that, when the fact it ends on the cliffhanger that they're not it's not over. Yeah,
and it's and of course the world has completely changed in that TV is now where the big money is, and where you can actually get a really decent budget for a genre show these days and do it properly, and actually give those characters room to breathe in a way that you might not be able to do that in a 90-minute film. I mean, we did. I'm very proud of the film. In that we did what we set out to do, which was to make a really thrilling film for kids that, you know, wasn't going to bore anyone and keeps everyone on the edge of their seats and is, mm-hmm. is good fun.
Yeah, no.
And that's all to do. So.
And also to prove your point, I mean, some, you know, like, for example, the American television series that made, like, there's $2 million an episode to make them things, as opposed to when you just said it's like $20 million for your film entirely, which kind of tells you the difference. It's an interesting transition. I wanted to just end, obviously, because obviously I've got your lovely book, which I'm showing on the video version right now.
Also available in ebook and audiobook. So the audiobook also has sound effects and from the film. And
Who was the voice actor that did that? I was reading about that earlier.
Brilliant audiobook reader called Rupert Degas, mm-hmm. who also does voices for various animation shows as well.
His reading
is terrific. It's something that I think it's a privilege to hear someone read not just a bit of your book, but the entire book.
Yeah.
And he really puts a lot into it. He really brings it to life. It becomes its own thing quite separate from the film. Mm. And it's wonderful to hear that.
Yeah,
I've had an exclusive short story. So I'm doing my pitch here.
Yeah, go for it. Sorry, man. I beg your pardon.
It's got an exclusive short story in the back, which again has none of the characters from the film. There's a little standalone thing. And for me, it's a
prototype, yes.
Yeah, it's the first bit of the expanded universe, if you like. And there are my shoot diaries in the back as well. So if you want to know more about how the film was made, I kept a diary all through the making of the film as well.
Yeah,
again, growing up reading things like the Close Encounters diaries, I love stuff like that.
So yeah, I'm with you. Being a huge geek that I am, I almost enjoy reading how stuff is made more than actual the film sometimes.
I really do.
I'm one of them annoying people, which I'm sure I'll make you laugh, is that I really try hard because the only people I go to cinema with are my best friends, because they kind of I'm aware of what I'm like, and I think they wouldn't be my oldest friends if they didn't. But I'm one of them people where I can't not comment on what's happening production wise because I've, you know, when you've been on certain productions and you sort of look at things, you start going, now why, how did they do that? And you start like out loud saying that in the middle of watching a picture. I'm one of them annoying ones who'll just talk about
it. Does being involved in film will kind of spoil films for you a bit,
yeah,
as you'll look at that and you do get used to seeing the joins, you know.
It's annoying, isn't it? Yeah, it's really annoying. It does kind of make you not enjoy things as much. But I've gotten better since I've been aware I do it. But anyway, So just in terms of, obviously, we mentioned the film, which I believe, can you get the film online anywhere?
The film is everywhere.
It's on Netflix, isn't it? As far as
not Netflix. It's on Netflix US. If you've got access to that, not Netflix UK, but it is. It's on Amazon. It's on DVD. It's on
that
Blu-ray.
Must be what it is, Amazon,
on Apple.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can get it pretty much everywhere.
And it's on DVD, isn't it? You can get it on DVD.
DVD, Blu-ray.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yes.
Some nice extras on the Blu-ray and the DVD as well. So featuring me.
Really? I did not know. I haven't got the DVD. So what's on the DVD extras? Like, pitch that.
There's a couple of making of things where we talk about the making of the film. There's a really fun one at the MCM Comic Con with Gillian Anson and James Tarpey. James Tarpey turns up. He goes all around the Comic Con. This is the one made by my school friend. This is a weird circle of life kind of thing. Me and my friend Jeremy grew up wanting to make movies. He's gone off. He makes documentaries. I said, come and help us out with the making of the film. And he couldn't do that, but he helped us with this brilliant little fun little piece where James goes to the Comic-Con, has fun at the Comic-Con, and asks Gillian Anderson out for a date.
Ah, nice.
It doesn't end well. It's good fun. It's really good fun.
Yeah. Awesome, yeah. And so in regards to the book, obviously, you know, if we mentioned obviously the film, but the book you recommend, obviously, because it goes into much more detail about the world and the characters and... And because as I would say, which I didn't, you know, I wasn't critical of, but the sort of backstory which you go into much more detail in here, the beginning of the film where it's like, oh, this happened and now this is where we're at. I get why you do that because obviously it's a film, but one of the things I like about books is that they actually go, no, this is what, you know, you have an actual prologue, you know.
Well, the other thing you can do is with a film, I think. Particularly if it's a genre film, it's a hero's journey kind of movie, your hero has to be single-minded and heading towards the end of the story. Whereas in a book, you can get inside the hero's head and the hero can have doubts and you know, have little moments where they're thinking, am I doing the right thing? Mm. And that's something you can kind of hint at in movies, but with books, books are so much better at getting inside the characters' heads. And
yeah, I agree.
I had great fun just building on what the John and I done with the script. In James, who's very briefly in the film, she's terrific in the film, in her cameo, but she wrote a little backstory for her character, which I've gleefully stolen for the book. You know, so there's little hints about her character's backstory in that, that you'll never know in the film, but it's she came up with it, it's what she used for her performance, and it's now in the book. So
awesome. Well, as I say, I encourage people to go check out the film. I've seen the film, I have the book, which I'm about two-thirds of the way through. I haven't finished it yet, but it's I'm enjoying it immensely. And I'd say thank you for signing it. It was very nice of you. And yeah, I'd say I encourage people to follow Mark on Twitter, which is at MarkStay on Twitter. We haven't mentioned your website very briefly. What can people find on your website? Is it just about you? Is there other stuff on it?
It's called Unusually Tall Stories. My first play was called Unusually Tall Boy. And it's mainly me waffling on about films and stories. Mm-hmm. I'm not that regular. Although this April... Mm-hmm. I will have been keeping a diary for 10 years. So what I might do is start putting some of those diary entries online, because that was, you know, it will take me from a writer who knew no one in the film industry to, after 10 years, getting a film actually made. So that might make interesting writers reading for, you know, if you're an up-and-coming writer.
No, of course, yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
I always love reading stuff like that, because it's one of the things that I think never gets published enough, is the journey to get to doing something successful.
Yeah, and it's there's this myth that once you've done one thing, then they open a door and you're part of this gang. But, I think any writer who's working for a living will tell you, you know, you're constantly working, constantly knocking on doors, constantly pitching, constantly having meetings, constantly writing stuff on spec. And it is hard. It's hard. And there's no one way to do it either. You know, everyone's going to find their own way to do it.
Yeah, so, I always, again, like I said, Paul Gerrard was a good example of this, who we've had on the show, is that I always like the way he described it of when people have this idea of that doing one film leads to opening another door. He's like, it may like jam the door open for a little bit longer than you would normally, but you still have to come up with a good idea.
Yeah.
Which is what I totally like the way he said that, because I think that's the mistake people make, is they go, oh, suddenly all these doors will open and you won't have to provide anything good. Which is not how it works.
No, it's not true at all. No. Again, the stakes in film, the stakes are very, very high. Even with a low-budget film, you could be talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of pounds, more money than you or I might ever see. And it's it's got to work. It's got to have an audience, you know. It's got to make its money back in the end.
But anyway, yeah, I'll not keep you any longer, but a huge thank you for being on the show. It's much, much appreciated. I wanted to just end by asking you, in terms of, you know, because we talked a little bit about influences for Robot Overlords, and I just wanted to ask you, one of the things I ended up feeling, especially when I watched the end of the film, was that it felt like, to me, kind of like a British War of the Worlds. Would that be fair to say?
It's fair to say. People have mentioned tripods, which John or I saw or read when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, there are lots of similarities. And this came up at a very early script stage. Someone mentioned tripods. And we went to Paddy Eason, our visual effects supervisor. We said, because he'd seen tripods, we said, God, have we ripped it off? Are we too close? He said, no, you're fine. It's just a few elements that are similar. And John and I sort of vowed never to watch it or read it while we were making the film, because we were accidentally influenced by it. But there's a lot of Amblin in there. There's a lot of 80s movies. We'd never seen an Amblin movie set in the UK. We wanted it to have that same feel, you know, a fun adventure movie, but with a lot of heart as well.
No, indeed.
And I think we did that.
I think you did. Right, I think that's a great way of ending. So as I say, I do encourage people to go follow Mark on Twitter, and please go to his website, unusuallytallstories.com. As I say, there'll be links in the description if you're watching this on our website, or listen to this on our website, or watching this, and you can find all the descriptions about Mark in the description links on iTunes if you're watching on there as well. Huge thank you to Mark for coming on. I much appreciate it. I need you to do a quick thing at the end of it, but I'll end the podcast. But huge thank you for coming on. It was lovely to speak to you at MCM London as well. And good luck with everything. I hope everything goes well.
And in the words of the great B-movie Robot Jocks, crash and burn. And we'll see you very soon, guys, for another edition of the Geek Podcast. Enjoy being a geek. Bye.